Thank you, Astrid, for that beautiful introduction and for setting up our conversation. I wish I was there with you all in the milieu of the not quite abandoned but closed coal mines of that region. And I would love to be able to tell you about how you could see the Zama Zama project, but I am asked to be a little quiet about that until an official statement is made. So I will defer that. So thank you all for being here. Thank you so very much, especially for those of you who have already devoted and given me so much time and attention over the last week. I want to begin by thanking my hosts and all those who have done so much to organize this event. I have, as I've said, you know, been speaking with a lot of you over the last week, although you may not know it. And this is because my thinking about media has over the years been so very deeply shaped by the conversations that have emerged there, where you are, you're here, in the haloed world that Astrid Dobrymankowski has enabled. Her thought on media, and especially on documentary and the documentary gesture, has been integral to my reflections on and reconception of the documentary projects with which I have been personally engaged over the past several years. And you will hear her voice in mine. And I hope, Astrid, you will not feel that this in any ways betrays your thought. You're going to hear, for those of you who have been present, some echoes of what I have spoken about over the last week, either with Northwestern or at Columbia at the Art History Conference on Decoloniality. But every return to the questions of this project leads me both to recapitulate what I thought I knew and to pose new questions that allow for what I thought I knew to be transformed in a kind of recurring eventfulness, which is a part of this project. So I'm going to speak today about three related issues, which I am going to sketch briefly in anticipation of an argument that will otherwise be woven together from divergent and occasionally digressive strands, hopefully not too digressive. I'm going to start by providing you with some background to the collaborative documentary project that Astrid has just mentioned and that I have been undertaking with undocumented migrant miners in Southern Africa. I'm going to do so while presenting to you a concept of the overseen as the eventful experience of viewing that which is given to be seen, but that cannot be fully anticipated. This is a notion to be distinguished from overlooking, which would imply an indifference to that encountered. I'm going to then try to relate this concept of the overseen to a notion of overhearing as a generalized condition of broadcast media, one that I nonetheless believe can be redeemed in and for a politicized documentary practice of distributed recording and faithful editing. I'm then going to consider whether the concept of overhearing as a condition of mass-mediated life under broadcast conditions, but also as a practice of active signification, can enable an understanding of viewing from afar under the conditions of what Astrid Dobrymankowski calls ubiquitous surveillance. And finally, I'm going to, that's a lot, I know. It hopefully won't feel like so much at the end, yeah? Finally, I'm going to consider the ethics of what I shall call documentary receipt rather than reception. This documentary receipt, with all the connotations of the gift that resonate within it, consists of a relation of obligation to those who give themselves to be seen and heard, despite and in the midst of surveillance. I offer it as an alternative, or perhaps, and you'll help me think this, as a supplement to positivist reception theories in which the tracking of circulation has come to substitute for the analysis of the social relations that can be produced in and through documentary practice. And the conception of receipt I'm proposing has embedded within it a notion of a collaborative but inevitably asymmetrical practice. And I hope to show how this practice can involve a sensory and sensuous politics of touch, wherein the aural, the visual, and the tactile are brought together to simulate the profilmic moment in a manner that retrospectively affirms the ontic while producing the appearance of verisimilitude. Such verisimilitude, born in the practice of editing, which some people reduce to the notion of post-production, is a way, I believe, of receiving and responding to the truth of what is given and to the truth of having been given, that which becomes a film. Okay, that's the very dense promissory note, theoretically knotted promissory note, and I promise not to give you a sequence of sentences like that for another 45 minutes, okay? Let me provide you with a little background. As an anthropologist, I have been working in and around the gold mines of South Africa for more than 25 years, trying to understand what it is that gold has made people do and want, and how the international monetary order that engulfs us all plays out in the places where extraction has been focused and where it has been specifically shaped by racial capitalism. Sometimes when I am surveying the wounded but still beautiful landscape, or the water-starved knots of informal settlements that are built over the extruded web of industrial mines infrastructure, and sometimes while talking to people for whom these amazements have receded to the level of background for the dramas of social life, sometimes I have found myself thinking that, but for seeing and hearing it myself, I could not have imagined this world and thus not learned what I have from the people who inhabit it. Having done so, and having watched some of the mines transition from intensive industrial production to ruin, I decided that I wanted to make a film or a filmic intervention about the lives of those who scavenge in the skeletal remains of global capitalism's monetary engine. These are people who are damned to live the legacy of that transformation internal to industrial capitalism that Walter Benjamin describes so well as the metamorphosis of waste into a source of value. Today, as the mines close due to the depletion of ores, the labyrinthine networks of shafts and tunnels have become the site of clandestine extraction in a re-manualized mode. This re-manualization is not a regression or a return to ancient forms of practice, however. It takes place in the infrastructural carcass of industrial life, which ensures that what happens or what appears like a recrudescence of ancient technique, whether of men hammering or women grinding, is something new. There is resemblance, but not continuity between the past and the present. Modernity has interrupted it and made of the past, at best, an uncanny recurrence. One of the measures of that discontinuity in this world is the sheer depth that must be traversed for gold to be extracted. Today, in these abandoned mines, men descend 2 and 3 kilometers below the surface of the earth without oxygen, without dewatering, without electrical transport, and spend days and sometimes weeks at a time in the pursuit of residual gold, gold which is too scant to legitimate major capital expenditures, but which is sufficient to sustain the corporeal labors of the gambler, come miner, who needs to feed only himself and his immediate dependents, but not the wraiths of dead capital that form the apparatus of the deep mining industry. In the area where I work, underground mining is done exclusively by men. The above ground labor that consists of crushing rock is done mainly by women, although it is they who breathe the rock dust and who are most likely to suffer what has for centuries been known as miner's lung. Sluicing and amalgamation, smelting and selling is the domain of men. The men who are illegalized both by virtue of being undocumented migrants from the neighboring states of Zimbabwe, Swaziland, Lesotho, and Mozambique, and to a lesser extent, Malawi, and by virtue of their transgression on the private property of the mining corporations, are called Zama-Zamas. Zama means to try in Zulu, and its reduplicative form, Zama-Zama, means to keep on trying, but also to gamble, and via a third onomatopoeic association, to resonate. Okay. Some of this, some of you already know, some of it Astrid has already touched on. But some of what follows, I hope, won't be so familiar. About 5 or 6 years ago, I asked some of the men whom I knew in the community where the scavenging occurs if they thought a film would be a good idea. I said I would hang around for a few days. If anyone was interested, they could find me at a particular place. In fact, at the home of the man who acts as the first point of contact for new migrants. A few days later, 3 young men showed up with a proposal to film underground with cameras that they wanted me to provide. They had no experience as cameramen, but they were willing to learn if I was willing to trust them with my equipment. And of course, they had much experience watching television and web-based media. Even in this electricity-starved world where the money for cell time is hard to come by and often irregular, they are knowing consumers of popular and journalistic media. The internet is the domain wherein they see and overhear the objects and discourses excreted by the desiring machines of capitalist modernity, where they engage with political questions, where they find the images of those whom they seek to resemble. Yes, their points of identification are with images, not necessarily with people. And they find there those around whose condemnation they form their bonds. The result of our ongoing work together is what Astrid has described for you briefly and what I call the Zama Zama Project. Among the project's constituent elements is a feature-length documentary entitled We Are Zama Zama, from which I'll show you some clips, and several short video works, as well as digitally manipulated frames from video footage that take the form of large inkjet prints. One of the short films, entitled The Film Is Being Made, and that we discussed last week, was born during the editing period on the feature documentary and was partially inspired by a conversation with Astrid Dauber-Mankowski that took place while I was at the time working with a group of translators in New York City while we were subtitling the underground footage that was generated by the miners. I had equipped them with GoPro 4S cameras, which had been chosen because they could accommodate low light, had long battery life, were light enough and could be mounted on body harnesses so that they would not interfere with the men's capacity to use their hands for either mining or to ensure their own safety. But the miners chose to take the cameras off their body harnesses for the most part, using those harnesses only when they were working intensively, as when lighting dynamite or hammering. And I'm going to come back at the end of this paper to this insistence on the hand, on the touch, on the nature of the manual in the space of deindustrialization, where it bespeaks a reappropriation at once aesthetic and technical of that which has been alienated. But first, let me say something about the editing process and about the nature of the receipt that I mentioned earlier and that defines the relationship which emerged within the contractually circumscribed terms of our ongoing project. The miners and I didn't start conceiving the actual filming until after many more conversations in which I learned more about what goes on in the abandoned mines, even though I had been speaking to Zama Zama miners for some years by this point. On one occasion, I and my director of photography, Ibrahim Haji, went into an abandoned shaft to get a sense of what it looks like, what it smells like, how it feels underfoot. I held him by his belt as he leaned over the shaft to record the gestures of our young friends as they descended to gather rocks in a purely demonstrative scouting exercise. We then discussed what it would mean to make a film that could communicate their experience. I urged them to think that everything they did underground was of interest to me and to others. How they travel, what they eat, how they sleep, where they rest or defecate, all the elements of survival in addition to the actual extractive process. And this was met with great enthusiasm on their part, for it is the degradation and physical difficulty of the work underground that they feel needs recognition and whose representation in the public sphere they hope will immunize them against the cruelties of those who would expel them from this world because they are illegalized migrants. When the men left for the underground for the formal shoot, my DP and I knew it would be days before they would return to the surface, the duration being determined by whether they found gold or not. And you can imagine that this was an extremely anxious period. But this duration is the sort of, I think, needs to be recognized as part of the non-abstracted kind of labor time that informs the system of value and scavenging. In any case, we agreed that they would phone upon their emergence. They have cell phones, which they use underground only to listen to music. And on the third day, they came back as if biblically preordained. They came back at dawn. Ibrahim and I received the cameras and took them back to Johannesburg to dump the footage. But before we did so, we went back to the home of the man who had introduced us and shot extensive interviews with the miners about their journey, this time on a larger but still lightweight DSLR. All of our shooting was determined by the demand for portability, because in this area, threat is everywhere and equipment must be chosen depending on the agility it permits. At any moment, one might have to flee. The first watch down was shocking to me. I could hardly breathe as I watched the men descend the shaft and then as they crossed the planks above another kilometer deep shaft that intersects their route. I had had no capacity to grasp this underworld. I've been down deep industrial mines before, but not like this, not into their ruins where death awaits every miner whose unknowing step dislodges a rock, every man who makes a wrong turn. Although it had been anticipating, my viewing was an event for me. It changed my perception. And this eventfulness does not disturb or displace the fact that the miners delivered the footage in a mode of future anteriority, confident that it would not only be seen by me, but that it would have been seen by them as well, because of course they filmed it. Except that when they saw the footage, they too were surprised and remarked how frightening this vision of the world from their perspectives when passed through the camera really was. The scene was so alienated that the morbid specter of death became palpable for them too, again, returning them to the moment of their first journey, which they all describe as terrifying. It is in this sense that I speak of an after-scene element, echoing the term overheard to evoke the experience of an eventfulness that arises on a horizon of the otherwise foreseen act of viewing. It is the name of a belatedness within the anticipation of an event. And what I'd like to do now, if I can, is show you that footage that so shocked them and that so shocked me. I'm going to show you an opening sequence from the film We Are Zama Zama, which I hope will be visible to you. If we have technical difficulties, forgive me. You know, it's always the joke of people who present in film workshops that they can't get it to play. But let's cross our fingers. And maybe Astrid, you can actually just tell me if you're seeing it as when we're ready, okay? Can you see that?
Yes.
Great.
Eh.
Ah, 20. Ah, no, 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 no. Come on, sir.
Right.
Okay, I hope, can you hear me again? Okay. Okay, by the time we had commenced this shooting, which I assume you saw as I did as a horrifying entry into a world of threat and danger, by the time we had commenced this shooting, we had abandoned the notion with which I had begun, that the men would never appear en face. When we began this project, I had assumed that we would shoot the entire film without ever showing anyone's face. I had assumed we'd use short depth of field, intense close-ups of an ear, an eyelash, a hand, abstract landscapes beneath or as accompaniment to the discourse of the audio recording. The clandestine nature of the work seemed to me to require that people be hidden from view, despite the fact that our shared goal was to produce a counterimage that could enter the South African public sphere. For Zama Zama miners are reviled in the South African media, accused of theft, imagined as violent and predatory parasites, and exposed to xenophobic violence. Such violence is, alas, the legacy of colonial segregationism and apartheid, backed by mining capitalism and orchestrated to serve it, but absolutely internalized at the level of the unconscious. The mandatory separations, expulsions, and incarcerations of Southern African people that were implemented through past systems and more violent forms of coercive state power now return in the form of nationalist sentiment, whose eradications will be one of the tasks of decolonization in South Africa. Nonetheless, in this context, the miners insisted that it was their most inviolate prerogative to show themselves, to claim their own stories, and to be seen as the ones who speak these stories. So in the midst of ubiquitous surveillance and at the knowing risk of exposing themselves, and we spent a long time discussing this, these men make a claim on being seen, where being seen is precisely being seen to speak. I accepted the demand and the responsibility that accompanies this, of mediating this desire to have not only a voice, but to have a face in public. One could say to have an image in public. One of the forms of this acceptance is the inscription of the men's names, not only in the credits of the films, which you saw, but as lower thirds in the documentary itself, a practice that risks my own aesthetic ambitions, but submits to their desire to recruit you and other viewers into a practice that enables their future recall. For the name is the vehicle of a becoming ancestral in this world. I want to now pause to consider what it means to be engaged in such a collaboration where people are filming their own lives, or rather filming from the perspective of their own corporeal practice, giving themselves to be seen in a manner that risks, as I said, and that Astrid Dobrymankowski has theorized, that risks exposure to ubiquitous media technological surveillance. The filming was undertaken by virtue of me, prompted and encouraged by me. But as I have discussed elsewhere, it was not addressed exclusively to me. Other possible addressees were conceived during the underground shooting, including not only other family members and perhaps especially children to whom the miners wanted to show the footage, but also the police, and even more importantly, the wives of the police, who would discover, they hoped, their husband's corruption. For the police often rob the illegalized miners of their samples or work with gangsters to do the same. The imaginative multiplication of addressees, which emerged from the actual practice of filming, opens the future of the miners to other possible social relations. And here you will hear the echo of the conversation that Astrid and I have been having. It did not produce those relations, I want to insist, however. It did not produce those relations, but it occasioned their imaginative envisioning. And time will tell which of these possibilities, if any, comes into being. Nonetheless, this temporal and futural fraying and unfurling is only one dimension of that which arises from filmmaking in this mode, which I will call distributed. I'm going to show you just 2 minutes from the film, a film is being made, in which you will hear these men speaking about the possible audiences of their filmmaking practice, okay? Those of you who are here on Thursday will have seen this. Those of you who weren't, hopefully it will be of interest. For those of you who have seen it, I hope perhaps you see something that you didn't see in the first viewing.
Vero fanele ukuba shute bethathe star.
Yeah.
Ngabe kuyavuma kusasa vele mawusithi uthi yathi kubabone bese zimisana sana nabo uhluba shute. Isibe vele ividiyo eyi-1.
Eh? Awubuhlungu.
Ngabhotsha. Kade sithi asibheke ifoni nomfazi wakhe.
Sesibona eh. Athi WhatsApp namatshe lawo.
Uthi shu umuntu lo osebenze kanje. This is the one who will lose in Tarantara.
Okay, we're back. Yeah, everyone okay? So I said that we could call this, we can talk about that sequence if you like, and I'll come back to it. But I said we could call this. The multiplication of addressees, an extension of or an effect of the futural fraying and unfurling of the film. And I said that this could be understood as one dimension of that which arises from a distributed mode of production, of making. It is, of course, common these days for people to distribute the technologies of self-documentation and to urge their use for documentary purposes, often in the name of a politics of self-representation, grounded in a desire for authenticity. These projects may be traced along two axes, one to the anthropologically enabled indigenous cinema movement, which, starting with the work of people like Terence Turner, rested on the belief that indigenous self-documentation could bypass the problem of colonial mediation. As Rachel Moore has so eloquently argued, much of the work that emerged from that early period was saturated by a demand for disclosure and by the identification and indeed reduction of the real to that which can be seen. She also notes what can be seen in the more recent works emerging from that tradition, namely the self-thematization and self-iconicization that seeks recognition from others under the name and in the form of an already read, already seen, and pre-coded visual sign of indigeneity. Such a politics leads, with a certain pathos, to the situation in which indigenous people must appear as traditional indigenes in full ritual regalia, for example, in order to be recognized as such and granted the rights and prerogatives that only accrue to them insofar as they are circumscribed in their exceptionality vis-a-vis the normed forms of non-appearance of the citizen. In this situation, we can speak of a foreseen iconicity, wherein tradition becomes the appearance of the unchanging. Now, in South Africa, the relevant term of comparison is not indigenous, but native, Where native, a synonym for black means, or in the colonial era, meant precisely that which is prior to and exiled from modernity. Under colonialism and apartheid, native signified the one who labors, and the entire history of apartheid can be understood as the effort on the part of the white minority to prevent the native laborer from entering, acceding to the domain of skill, of craftsmanship, and on that basis of relatively improved remuneration and recognition. Now, I'll come back to this point, but let me leave that thought for a moment and return to the question and the tradition of indigenous cinema. Of course, that form of anthropologically fetishistic self-iconicization does not exhaust the forms of distributed documentary production today, when it is common for township youth or otherwise marginal communities to take up low-cost and portable recording technologies in the service of counter-documentary projects. They aim at multivocal and situational storytelling, which nonetheless has to negotiate the demand for accessibility or universalizability, and which often, as a result, has to repress the problem of translation while submitting to an implicit fantasy of mediatic transparency. But what I am trying to describe does not rest on a fantasy of, or is not limited to a fantasy of multivocality, which may or may not accurately describe a more or less collective production process. Rather, I'm speaking of a multilingual collaboration of a different order. There is a need to distinguish collaborative and collective production, just as there is a need to recognize that multivocality and communicative transparency are often contradictory tendencies. For me, collaboration is a term that accommodates and acknowledges the asymmetries which obtrude within a filmmaking process that is conditioned by other social asymmetries in a decolonizing context, such as the one in which I work. One of the forms of appearance of this asymmetry arises in the editing process, which I want to now discuss. As I've already said, I watched the footage that I shared with you in belated and stunned horror as I observed the world opening to and opened by the cameras by the young miners. As I said, my relationship to documentation is constantly tarrying with a sense of the unbelievable and unforeseeable nature of that for which my experience has not prepared me, and an effort to imagine how this can be made to appear. I worked with translators who speak the precise dialects of all the people working underground. During this process, I found myself increasingly captivated by all of the discourse about making a film that was occurring as the men went about their business underground and as they learned to orchestrate the shots. And I described this last week. I described being in awe as they identified narrative elements in the story that they wanted to be seen and heard, estimated how much time they had left on batteries and calibrated this with the tasks yet to be formed. Argued about how many cameras to use for a scene, about the angles of each shot, and of course, about the status of their speech in the final film. These elements were edited together in the film, A Film Is Being Made, which I showed you a clip of. But more common than the piquant discourse about making the film and about its possible reception are conversations about the routes taken from hometowns to the mines, in which the names of individual buses and landscapes traversed are described in minute detail. There's also great talk about music, about individual episodes of violence, about women, about the burdens of tradition with respect to sexual life, about elders. But the most extensively depicted dimensions of underground life are those of actual extraction, a process minutely documented through precise and elemental reductions. Beyond this is the lovingly filmed part of the underground life that is spent socializing with others, mainly over meals. These are often scenes of verbal wit and repartee across many languages. That is to say, they are exchanges that are not for us. They are exchanges in which men admire each other's linguistic virtuosity and mock their rivals in languages that those same men don't understand. The ideal of this play is captured in the Chitonga aphorism, "I could kill you with words and you wouldn't even know it." Men spoke, of course, about me and about white people, about those who would see the film. You saw that in the clip I showed you. Not only about the audiences of documentary cinema, whether they be white or not, but their own children, their friends, as well as the police and relatives of the police, those wives whom they hoped to shame with the film. In one moment, the men discuss the possibility that their voices will be heard and wonder how this will be dealt with. Their consciousness of being overheard no doubt incited a certain self-objectification, as when the young men discuss in relatively elaborate ways their disgust at violent bravado, or speculate on the sexual customs of those with whom they do not share a tradition and whom they presume to be less enlightened than themselves. But over the course of hours and days, the camera and its recording apparatus became a relatively overlooked prosthesis, one whose presence was not so much ignored as accommodated and internalized. My relationship to this discourse is that of overhearing. Their speech comes to me like the messages of any other broadcast media, which circulate in the public sphere, in which I am anticipated as a possible reader or auditor, but not as the only or ideal reader, nor as a particular recipient. Or at least that is one dimension of the speech that comes to me. The broadcast media sphere is one in which messages are sent to anyone who might be in a position to receive them. Their addressee is open. However, and at the same time, the recordings made underground are not quite this general, and they might be better described as internally divided, such that speakers, at least the men bearing the cameras, are speaking both to their immediate interlocutors and to me and others like me, as well as to others in their extended social world and its futures, people whom they desire to hear them. The address is differential and striated. Only some of those addresses can be heard by people like me and people like you, and differently by both of us. Now, in this relationship, it's important to mark another distinction, and this one on the side of the auditor. Just because these recordings give themselves to be heard by anonymous and indeterminate auditors does not mean that the one who receives them can remain thus. She is not a mere occupant in the dispersed field of possible reception. She is the recipient not only of footage, not only of recording, but of an act, a speaking or a giving to be heard. And this receipt, and I say receipt and not reception, binds her according to the law of the gift. That law, as theorized by Marcel Mauss, is the law that demands first that gifts be given. But beyond that generic principle, it demands that one receive the gift, that one return the gift, and that time and difference enter so that the return is not a cancellation, but a bond, an extension in time of a relation. For anthropologists, this is one way of describing the social in situations that are not fully alienated and commoditized. And it is imperative to recognize, contra the rereading of Mauss that Claude Lévi-Strauss undertook and that informed all of structuralism in its wake, that the process cannot be abstracted to the point of being rendered as exchange, without at the same time effacing the constitutive asymmetries that define each moment, each act in the sequence. When the miners give their footage to me to be heard, they momentarily indebt me. But every such act is also a risky submission on their part to the terrifying possibility that the one who receives their gesture, me, will refuse its implications, which is not to be confused with refusing the object given. And this is what the men refer to when they speak of white journalists and others who, as they say, feed off them and whose self-engorgement is the betrayal of the gift, the refusal of a social relation. Now, in the kind of collaboration I'm describing, editing is an extended effort to receive this gift of a recording that gives itself to be heard. And it is for this reason that I speak of receipt rather than reception. Yet this begs a further question of how precisely one is to receive in this mode of belated listening. For overhearing is not merely a listening in, as it were, it is also a relation of the signifier that is dislocated from its origin, such that one hears or interprets in a manner that brings to bear significations neither intended nor anticipated by the speakers. Now, there's a theory of culture and indeed of the public sphere, which presumes it is the scene where one aims to produce shared meanings for equally accessible signifiers. But my understanding of the public sphere is that it works precisely by virtue of the opposite principle, namely that shared signifiers can sustain different and even contradictory significations, and that this capacity for the signifier, to accommodate different readings rather than convergent ones. Rather than convergent ones is the condition of possibility of democratic coexistence. James Siegel gives us a fine example of this when he describes practices that may seem to an outsider to be acts of obeisance made by women to men. He's talking about late colonial Indonesia. These acts, he says, are understood by the men to be acts of deference on the part of women, but they are understood by the women to be gestures of contemptuous indulgence. The same act, the same signifier sustains distinct significations, and this integrated dissonance is what lets people get along. Of course, there are moments when this difference fails to permit anything other than a passing by of communicative gestures. Consider, for example, the following. In an extended sequence of footage that is not in any film, the miners speak about a series of bands and of their alternations, of the exhaustion of one, the appearance, disappearance of another. One band after another. The miners, whose voices are heard in the footage, all say that they want to find one of those bands. This discourse accompanies the acts of sampling and sifting sand to discern the presence of gold. And it is interspersed with remarks about the likely percentages of gold in the sand and the degree to which it merits further blasting. Now, bandi is a word used to describe the seam or vein of ore-bearing rock where gold is to be found. One of the miners, Bagani, analogizes it for me with the veins of his arm, and he traces the subterranean flow of blood with his finger while describing how he has learned to observe the rock and to know what flows through it. This explanatory discourse with Bakani gesturing to his own exposed flesh is part of the film We Are Zama Zama. I spent a week translating this scene about the bands with Noel Muzukutwani and Tanya Nyati in New York. Noel is a native speaker of Chitonga and Tanya is a native speaker of isiZulu and isiNdebele as well as Shona. And we felt confident that the conversation about the bands was well translated and continuous. But when I took the translated and subtitled footage back to share with the miners, as I always do before finalizing a sequence, I discovered that the band being referred to in the scene I've just described was the surname of a family with seven daughters who had been married to seven men who were kin. The alternations were of women, not of veins of rock, and the desired bands were these same women. The miners who explained that a seam of rock is like an arterial line laughed when we watched this and said, it's like I said to you, Mr. Band has seven Miss Bands. In this world where common nouns are often names, the doubleness of speech had been lost on me and on the native speaking translators. It was impossible to convey this doubleness in subtitles and the scene disappeared from all of my films. I've already described to you the forms of competitive banter in which the witty mockery of someone in a language that they cannot understand permits the performance of a verbal virtuosity that can elicit admiration from one group of people at the expense of the exiled object of ridicule. But there are also moments when a convergence is desired or becomes necessary, when the signifier becomes the locus for something like a touch. And I will repeat this phrase now, and move to a consideration of the relationship between what I have called the overseen and the afterseen. Something like a touch. The receipt of the footage in the context I have described requires and enables something like a touch. I want to persuade you that this occurs in and through an editorial practice, and especially the editing together of the image and the soundtrack. And in the case of my own work, I have tried to mobilize this touch for an ethics of collaboration by permitting the relation between the image and the soundtrack to be metonymized in a manner that binds seeing and hearing and responds to the historically given but not yet coded fact of remanualization, so that it comes to imply more than a loss of modern technology, but becomes rather the gesture of a possible relation. Before I can persuade you of this, we need one last detour and rethink a bit what we mean when, as theorists of film, we speak of tactility or of the haptic, terms that are almost exclusively deployed as descriptors of spectatorial experience. Often when people speak about the haptic dimension or tactility of film, they are referring to the experience of the spectator who responding to an especially intense and sometimes overwhelming imagery or soundtrack are affected, moved, and corporeally enervated. This is not, however, what I mean to invoke with this concept, which, when considered within the context of this receipt and editorial practice, refers to the impression of the ontic in the mediatic. Conventional sound editing practice supports the hallucinatory coherence of the film with a low drone, and you may have heard that in the descent in the tunnel at the first, in the first clip I showed you. It supports the hallucinatory coherence of the film with a low drone or a constant sound that traverses the visually discontinuous shots of a sequence. In the case of my film, where the disorientations of the underground are so extreme and to which many viewers respond with a sense of vertigo, this sonic continuity is something like a lifeline. Our editorial decisions, those of Pascal Tremel and me, were often focused on the question of how much an audience member could bear before turning away. And my goal was to push it as far as possible without losing the viewer. When the miners first saw the first cut of the film, as I mentioned, they responded with surprise and said that they found it much more frightening to watch the film than to actually descend in the mine. But the most disconcerting moments of the edit were those in which we did not have recordings of the bodily gestures and points of contact between bodies and the object world, including the earth on which a foot falls and the brush of fabric against a body, an absence occasioned by the fact that we recorded voices outside with body mics and a boom wrap to resist wind noise. The result was a thingless, contactless soundtrack. And this had to be compensated for, as it was and as it commonly is, with Foley sound. Now, there are documentarists who resist this temptation. And I think here of Lisa Stevenson's decision in her film Into Unknown Parts about mistranslation between Canadian Inuit people and colonial authorities in the period of mandatory residence in tuberculosis sanatoria. Her decision to forego any supplementary sound and the resulting fact that the film is punctuated by moments of absolute sonic nullity produces a disconcerting effect, and one that her sound editor resisted ferociously. And every screening has a moment when people assume that the projection technology or speakers have failed. But even beyond such extreme decisions, there are many who believe the retrospective filling in of the film to be a dishonest substitution for a failed recording by an artificially perfect simulation. But I think of it differently. I think of it as the enactment of a fidelity to the ontic, a regrounding of the image in the inaccessible but representable actuality of experience. This is somewhat different from what Michel Chion describes for us with the notion of the added value of the soundtrack in a film, which he argues enables the illusion of the non-necessity of sound in film. This appearance of non-necessity arises, he says, because of the suturing together of image and soundtrack that makes sound appear like a reproduction of what is already in the image track. But the syncresis of which he writes in Audio Vision is for the spectator. I am speaking about a relation produced in and for the directorial editor of a distributed documentary. Now, as with the moment of Chion's added value, this arises or becomes most palpable, and I'm now in the idiom of touch, fully in the idiom of touch, in those moments when what one sees is a point of contact, a coming together of surfaces, a touching of the world by and of itself in a manner that Merleau-Ponty in his last works taught us to understand. It's not that one cannot do interesting things by betraying expectation or overwhelming the diegetic sound with foreign elements. The foot falls on gravel and may be accompanied by any sound or by music, or it may go unheard. But if the foot falls on gravel and is heard to fall on gravel and is accompanied by the sound of that soul's grinding sand and pebble, then the point of contact must entail a point of touch between image and soundtrack, such that a single line cuts through and traverses the entire sweep of the sensorially perceptible signifying field from index to symbol. I want to show you two little moments, one without and one with. A sound edit. Am I okay for time, Astrid? Am I good? 5 minutes. Am I okay with that? All right, I'm going to share my screen once more. I have to call up 2 moments of the film, so please bear with me for a second. So this is from a pre-sound edited version of a short sequence. Whoops.
The Bible says that I would to be going to Mundomiama.
Ah, yeah, Pogangas is your sass. By Intuta, Ogo Sisogol, I'm Tambi Petting or Goose of Leg Mine.
It was of Leg is mine.
Mr. Benz of Leg, go be my corner and go to
my Pelang and
Pelang. I call as Ava Lunchy, Babu Patum Domiam as Ava. Football, but Gabriel, they do Patum Domiam. Basvala nganjalo.
Yavala manje mase kuthiwa sokufingena freedom.
Freedom basvala.
Okay,
I'm going to ask you to give me 2 seconds as I find the other footage. We tried this beforehand and of course I made a mistake with it. You can talk amongst yourselves, as they say. All right, I'm gonna switch back and share screen again. Can you see that? This is the same sequence now sound edited.
That's the Shosas. By Intuta, Ogo Sisogol, I'm Tambi Petting or Goose of Leg Mine.
It was of Leg is mine.
Mr. Benz of Leg, go be my corner.
You might like Pelang and
Pelang. I call as Ava Lunchy, but Patum Domiam is over. Football, but Gabriel, they do Patum Domiam. Basvala nganjalo.
Yavala manje mase kuthiwa sokufingena freedom.
Freedom basvala.
Okay, that's my last screen share. In the sound edit for my films, I find this moment of producing contact, which I hope you could hear. I hope you could hear the difference between the first and the second sequence, one of which you can hear the foot touch. I find this moment of producing contact to be a moment of nearly sublime submission to its sub, to the film's subject, and to the notion of a documentary ethics in which the actuality of those whose lives to which it offers its testimony subordinates everything else. This submission to the ontic dimension, to the having been, and indeed to the being there of another and all that exceeds me. This submission, which is not yet an ontological claim and which wants to resist metaphysics, constitutes for me a crucial moment in the relation that begins with a receipt and opens to the future where the response must be produced. This cinematic practice, an apparently banal matter of editorial technique, is, I want to argue, the form of response to what is given, as well as to the eskipt, the givenness of the actual, when and because it is given to be seen in the mode of documentary. Now, I've implied that this touch, which is not given by technology, but which technology can enable, is somehow related to a more general phenomenon of remanualization. And I need to try to explain in concluding what I mean. What I don't mean is a technological regression, a relinquishing of modern forms of practice. So let us recall what I noticed earlier, that the men whom I hoped would wear their cameras and body harnesses took them off, not only because they said it irritated them, but because they wanted to hold the camera, to see the image as it was being made via the digital screen on the camera's backs, and to manipulate that image, to produce it. This gesture, this foregrounding of the hand, of the manual, draws our attention to the hand as both a signifier of the laboring body and of its transcendence in the notion of a crafting handiwork, handwerk or métier, as Derrida reminds us, But just as the hand of handwerk is lost in the French translation as métier, the laboring body is lost in the figuration of the hand as the sign of an unmarked humanity in a Heideggerian phenomenology. Industrial mining technology always promises to reduce dependency on physical human labor. Yes, it is always the promise of the elimination of the black body, even as its ruination and wastage lead people back to a form of non-waged, not pre, but post-wage labor, in which the body's capacities and needs go increasingly unsupplemented by mechanical technology. What is it that can be seen? What are we being given to see when the men take the camera in hand, when the shadow of that handheld camera, which in another idiom and another domain is the very mark of the authentic, slides across the surface of the rock? Are we to find there the double of a dream image from Platonic allegory? Perhaps, but only if this allegory is reread with irigaray, so that we can understand that what is projected is the effect of tradition pretending to be identity. But that's not my focus here. I read this gesture as one in which the men appropriate the technology as a means of insisting on their irreducibility to the apparatus. If one considers that they are what they're doing in comparison, for example, to the use of GoPros in Lucien Castaing-Taylor and Verena Paravel's film Leviathan, where the cameras are strapped onto torsos, legs, boots, and fish so as to generate a subjectless eye, entirely coextensive with the apparatus, one gets a sense of what these men want to avoid. Their hands are the extensions of their eyes, and only in taking seeing into their own hands can they give themselves to be seen as those who speak, who can tell their own stories, and who can imagine addressees beyond and behind me and every recipient of their self-filming. Now, I'm going to stop here. And I've spoken for a very long time, and you have been patient, and I'm grateful for that. There's a lot that I think that I'm interested in discussing about this question of the hand, but also of the question of time. But I'm going to leave it to you to tell me if there's anything that's worthy of our picking up in a extended conversation.